This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Early voting starts next week. Gubernatorial candidates have wrapped up the last of their debates. So have you heard enough to make a choice in the voting booth? What issues are motivating you to get to the polls for this primary? Is it toxic algae, the economy, healthcare, or other issues that are top of mind for the election? Meanwhile, the Senate contest between Bill Nelson and Rick Scott continues. And primary tussles in the 7th and 9th congressional districts heat up, and mayoral candidates in Orange County wrangle over jobs, housing, crime, and other issues. What are you looking for in the next mayor of Orange County? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation there, and you can reach us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. We're joining us in studio, Republican political analyst Michelle Ertel. Welcome back, Michelle.
Hello.
And we're joined as well by Democratic political analyst Dick Batchelor. Dick, welcome back to you.
Good to be back. Thank you.
All right. So the GOP debates, Adam Putnam and Ron DeSantis facing off for the second and final debate. It was much more substantive on the Florida issues front, but just how much of a difference is it going to make? You know, the two GOP candidates running for governor hammering each other on things like the environment, campaign funding. Let's just hear a little bit from Adam Putnam criticizing Ron DeSantis' record on the environment.
You haven't even fought to help the St. John's River in your own backyard. Florida's water issues are statewide, from Apalachicola Bay and the collapse of our oyster industry to the St. John's, which is the key to Jacksonville, the River City, as well as our 43 first magnitude springs. The feds are way behind what the state commitment has been in South Florida. Lake Okeechobee's the beating heart. And we have to have more storage and more water farming north of the lake.
All right, so that's Adam Putnam. They're talking about water storage and just taking a few shots at Ron DeSantis' opponent in the Republican primary. Michelle Ertel, just how important is the issue of water and the environment for Putnam's constituency?
It's hugely important. People in Florida care about the water. DeSantis hit back at him when talking about that. Mm-hmm. He blamed the toxic algae blooms in Florida waters on Big Sugar. Mm-hmm. Putnam got a ton of money from Big Sugar. So he punched back, and I think he did it adequately.
And actually, we have some tape of that, too. Let's just hear Ron DeSantis kind of going toe-to-toe with Adam Putnam, talking about that sugar and the funding of his campaign there.
Well, look, Commissioner Putnam, his argument to Southwest Florida and to the Treasure Coast is effectively going to be pound sand, because he will not do anything that offends U.S. Sugar, who is his main supporter. He's going to let them do what they need to do and all these other things. I'm not saying some of them aren't worthwhile, but at the end of the day, if you let one company call the shots, we're going to continue to end up having the problem.
All right, so that's Ron DeSantis there, really kind of putting Adam Putnam on notice, talking about his connections to the agricultural industry. Michelle, I mean, is that Putnam's biggest weakness here in this campaign, his connection to those agricultural interests? Do voters care?
Well, voters care a little bit, I think. But look, Putnam went into this race being ahead. I mean, everyone knew him. He had high name ID. He mm-hmm. is on every gas pump in the state of Florida. So people knew who he was going into this. But DeSantis has the Trump endorsement, which Putnam said that he wished that the president had not put his thumb
on
the scale. Yeah. So DeSantis has really pulled ahead since that endorsement. Now he's just kind of filling in the blanks, letting people know what they didn't know before.
Mm-hmm. And we should note, too, that Putnam kind of hit back at DeSantis, saying that, well, really 90% of his contributions for his campaign came from real Floridians. I wonder, though, about the sort of bipartisan nature of this issue, particularly Dick Batchelor. Does it strike you that when you talk about environmental issues, the likes of what they were talking about there, especially the toxic algae in the St. Lucie area, is that something that you feel is kind of more in the wheelhouse of the Democratic candidates or something that Republican voters are particularly attuned to this time around as well?
First of all, I think toxic algae pretty well described the debate, because that was toxic algae. It really was. And
why do you say that?
But just that they were bitter. They were very personal going after each other. But that you have to go negative when you're behind. Negative works. We don't like to say that, but it works. The campaigns, Putnam's behind. I agree with Michelle. And DeSantis moving ahead in the fundraising now, and he's also been endorsed by Trump. I think the Koch brothers are probably behind his campaign, too. So it's interesting. The environmental issue uses a Democratic issue, and I want to talk about that later, but I want to go back on the campaign for a moment here, and that is, if you look at it, you know you're in trouble when you've got one Republican candidate attacking another candidate for taking money from U.S. Sugar. Because U.S. Sugar usually floods the campaign coffers of Republican candidates. And then you know you're in trouble when Adam Putnam is attacking DeSantis for taking Koch Brothers' money. Koch Brothers being the sugar daddy. The Republican Party, they're going to spend $400 million in campaigns this year, right, across the nation. So you know it's really a mix-up when you're attacking each other for really the sugar daddies of both parties. Mm-hmm. But on the environmental issue, the Democrats, I won't talk about that later because I think it's a real key issue in the Democratic primary.
Mm-hmm. And we want to hear from you, too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can reach out to us on Twitter as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. I want to hear what issues are driving you to the polls. What did you hear in that Republican primary debate, if you watched it or if you listened to some of it afterwards? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can reach out to us on Twitter as well. Taking your comments and questions there. Healthcare was another issue that came up as well. This one they seemed a little more in agreement on. Here's Adam Putnam talking about how healthcare is gobbling up the state budget. Let's take a quick listen.
Health and Human Services is 42% of the state budget. It's the Pac-Man of our state budget. Goes up every year. It's way past what we spend on education. In fact, Medicaid alone is $28 billion that we spend in Florida. So, taking what the feds were trying to put on us was not the right move. It would have bankrupted our state and taken us backwards.
And they sort of went on a little bit more about health care. DeSantis kind of in agreement with Putnam there. Here's a question, though, that the moderator asked of both candidates. Just have a quick listen to this, too.
Is health care a right for all?
It is not a right for all.
Thank you, Mr. DeSantis.
What I think you have a right to do is pursue the type of health care you want. Obamacare infringes on your freedom to be able to do that.
Is it a right for all?
I think people should have the right to pursue the type of health care that they want.
Dick Batchelor, I could hear the wheels turning for Democratic candidates watching that part of the debate and saying, here is something we can jump on. What are you seeing in the aftermath of that?
Absolutely. The fact is the Republican leadership, the governor, and the leadership of the House, the Senate actually passed a Medicaid expansion, but the House would not. So the Republicans have denied health care coverage to 800,000 Floridians. We would have gotten $50 billion in federal money over the next 10 years to provide for health care for those who are now qualified for Medicaid but not receiving it, and most of whom are children, by the way. So I think they're wrong. I think this issue is going to be a tremendous issue because health care across the board is rates in the polls very high. People are desperate for health care coverage across the board.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Littell, what did you make of that little exchange towards the end of the debate there?
Well, I think that it was interesting, and I think that is the Republican line. We think that you should be have the right to pursue whatever kind of health care you want. You shouldn't have to have it forced on you. So I think that it is going to be used by Democrats. They're going to pick and choose lines from that debate that they're going to run on loop, and I expect them to do that. And I'm sure whoever our candidate is will respond in kind.
Mm-hmm. Come the general election, though, once we get through August, what would you expect the Republican candidate to do? Are they going to somehow walk back from that position a little bit?
No, I think they're going to dig in their heels. Mm-hmm. You know, in Republican polling, internal polling that I have heard, the number one issue among Republicans is immigration. So I think that Republicans are going to be talking about immigration. Democrats are going to force Republicans to respond by talking about health care.
Mm-hmm. Well, health care and immigration are a couple of the issues there. Maybe that's something that's on your mind as you're heading to the polls. Maybe you're thinking about early voting. 1-866-338-5252. Love to hear some of your comments as well. What did you hear in that debate? What were you hearing from the Democratic candidate forums and debates in recent weeks as well? Just tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are on the issues and what you want to hear from the candidates going forward. Well, let's talk about those Democratic debates and forums. Dick Batchelor, I mean, it sounds to me that the environment is a pretty key topic there. What are you hearing from the candidates, and is there much to differentiate them, candidates and all?
I think so. Going back the last time we did this show, I offered some free advice for the Republican Party, and that was they did not. The candidates were going to be nice to each other, go hard on the issues, don't get personal. They've gone personal. Otherwise, I think you would have had a Putnam DeSantis Putnam ticket would have been almost an unbeatable ticket, but it's not going to happen now. In fact, the DeSantis has already started listing potential running mates, a little presumptive close on the campaign. Mm-hmm. But I think environment is going to be real key in the primary. What you have, which I think is unfortunate because they're not abiding by my advice either, and yet that's, you've got Jeff Green attacking Gwen Graham, who I'm supporting. I would disclose that.
Wait, so you're supporting who?
I'm supporting Gwen Graham. But as an example of the environment, you've got Jeff Green attacking her before building a mall in the Everglades, which is a little bit misleading. But she has the endorsement of Everglades Trust. But the point is that environment is a big issue. But as far as the Democrats laying out a plan, there's not been very much except a talk about the Everglades. Of course, that is in South Florida, which is where the most of the votes come in the Democratic mm-hmm. primary. And there's three counties in the South, so they're focused on the Everglades, but I haven't seen any candidate yet lay out very specific of what I would do if I were elected governor.
Mm-hmm. That slime is probably going to make its way north, though, right? It's not just confined to the South.
Are we talking politics? Or
we're talking about the actual, the toxic algae.
Oh, that, yes, it probably will.
10 times more dangerous to touch than it should be or something like that. Yes. I read some stat there yesterday. Pretty alarming stuff.
Well, I'm surprised. I hope the Democrats in the primary and general election start talking about things like Scott's appointments to the Water Management District. The Water Management District is supposed to be regulating this. But if you look at the appointments made by Scott, they're really mostly developers and realtors and people who, in my opinion, have a conflict. And if I were elected governor, if I were a candidate, I would say that I would reappoint new members to the water management districts to better reflect trying to protect the natural resources of the state of Florida.
Speaking about reflection, there has been quite a bit of soul-searching going on in the Republican Party in the last couple of years. You know, what does it mean to be a conservative? What does the Republican Party look like going forward, Michelle? I wonder, though, is this also a moment of kind of self reflection for the Democratic Party in this election, particularly if you look at the race for the governor's mansion on the Democratic side? What do you see in that race, Michelle? Like, is this a kind of a referendum on what the Democratic Party should be and do?
Well, I think it is. I mean, we're talking about old Democrats, center Democrats, Gwen Graham, basically.
And you mean old as in the kind of the thinking
correct.
Or the
old school
traditions?
I'm not offended.
but you agree, the older, more traditional Democrats, like mm-hmm. like Gwen Graham, people would say that she's a bit blue doggy.
Which means that you can kind of tack towards the center or the right on some issues from time to time.
Right, right. And that's the way the Democratic Party used to be. But it's gone way, way, way left, almost to socialist. I mean, if you listen to some of the Bernie Sanders followers. So I think that it is a referendum, whether the party wants to go back to how it was or whether it wants to be more Bernie Sanders-like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm seeing Gwen Graham is pulling this out, which, by the way, would be very hard to beat. She's
in the general?
I think she's going to be hard to beat in the general, especially if it's DeSantis. Yeah, I think it's going to be very hard. I think Putnam, who's generally more moderate, would have more of a shot.
Although in the primary, we have seen a Putnam who seems quite hard line on a lot of issues, a little more conservative than you might expect.
They all do that, you know.
Primary, yeah.
Republicans run to the far right, Democrats run to the far left. Once the general starts, they go to the middle. I think what folks need to look at is their actual records before they decided to run.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you'll get a real feel of where they stand.
1-866-338-5252 is the number if you want to weigh in on the Democratic primary or the Republican primary in the gubernatorial race. Some of the other races we're looking at as well, some of the congressional races, Congressional District 7 and 9, and of course the mayoral campaigns going on too. I want to ask, though, about election meddling. Democratic Senator Bill Nelson asserts Russians have penetrated some Florida voter registration systems. He was a little bit cryptic about it. Here is Senator Nelson talking to Alex Leary of the Tampa Bay Times about the issue.
What do you mean by they're in the election records? What do you mean by that?
Just exactly what I said. They have already penetrated certain counties in the state, and they now have free rein to move about.
All right, so Senator Nelson there saying the Russians are here, essentially. Dick Batchelor, yep. What do you make of that?
Well, some people responded to that saying, well, it's an unfounded claim. But the fact is, he said it was based on some confidential, if not secret, briefings, I guess, from one of the agencies, state agencies, or federal agencies, I should say. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, with all that's going on in the debate nationally about the Russian interference, and they, in fact, every national security advisor to the president at a press conference came out and said Russians are meddling in the 2018 races. They mm-hmm. are going to be involved in it if we don't stop them. In fact, the Congress, by the way, turned down $450 million in appropriations for actually helping supervise elections around the country guard against that. So I think the perception is that it could be very real.
But there's a difference, though, between attempting to meddle in an election and trying to influence things and actually having hacked into a mm-hmm, system, mm-hmm. which seems to be what Senator Nelson is asserting. You know, we had Seminole County Supervisor of Elections, Mike Attell, on the show last week.
Guy. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes, you do, pouring cold water on the notion that the election system in mm-hmm. Florida was hacked. I mean, Dick Batchelor, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, Michelle, tell your husband that I'm unsure. No, I mean, I have to take Senator Nelson at his word, but he mm-hmm. might have information we don't have. But, you know, the National Security Agency leaders last week in the White House basically said the Russians are trying to meddle with and interfere with our 2018 election. So I have to believe that they are.
You know, the Department of Homeland Security wrote a letter yesterday in response to Senator Nelson that said an attempt is basically it didn't happen, that he's simply wrong. They sent a phishing email to the mm-hmm. supervisors of elections. Not a one – they did attempt, but not a one opened it. They didn't get into the database. They sure tried, but they weren't successful. So there are some folks that are concerned with what Senator Nelson has said, particularly the Office of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm. Does this look then like a political play to you, Michelle Otero?
I think maybe he's confused. Maybe he heard something and it's unsubstantiated, because my information is that it just simply didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Not that the Russians didn't want it to happen, but it didn't.
But they could try again.
And they will.
Right. And that seems to be the information that people are that you know, intelligence agencies and others are getting, right? There's going to be another attempt at some point if there isn't already.
Right.
Let's talk about Congressional District 7. What's happening in the standoff between Scott Sturgill and Mike Miller? The biggest difference between them, Michelle Urtel, I mean, Sturgill is essentially accusing Miller of being a liberal, which I guess is a dirty
word.
They're
accusing each other of being a liberal. You know, Scott was a Democrat in college. You know, Mike Miller's has liberal votes. Whatever. If you get the mail like I do, you would think that they are both terrible, terrible people. And the fact is, I know them both and they're both friends. And they're nothing like their mailers. I'm sorry if they're listening and they paid for them. But when you know these guys, they're both moderates. And they're both... Not during the primary, they wouldn't. But they're both really reasonable guys. And I'm surprised at the tone this race has taken.
Are they going to be friends after the race?
No way.
No.
Dick Batchelor, then, what about the Democratic primary on that side? Is there a strong challenge for Stephanie Murphy from Chata Richardson?
Not at all. And I think, based on what Michelle has said, too, it puts Stephanie Murphy in a very strong position. You know, she is, I think, voted recently as the seventh most bipartisan Democrat in the Congress, voting with the Republicans on certain issues. She's gotten legislation passed.
Which could be a terrible thing in some districts if you're
It could, but not in a district that is held by John Michael for 24 years as a Republican. So I think she's strong there. I think the Republican primary, and I know both of these gentlemen, too, and it's interesting, as a Democrat, I hate to see them fight like that, but I hope they keep doing it. But it's interesting because you've got Mike Miller, who said he would be in favor of Medicaid expansion when he ran but changed his mind and voted against it, is being attacked by Sturgill for being supportive of Medicaid expansion. And then apparently Sturgill said someplace that he was in favor of the Affordable Care Act. So you've got Mike Miller attacking him. So they're both attacking each other as being liberal on the same issue. Mm-hmm. So it's confusing to the to the voters, I think, but they're both raising a pretty good amount of money.
They are, and you know, this is an Orange Seminole race.
Right.
Mike Miller is very well known on the Orange County side of things,
having been in the legislature.
Right, yeah. Right, and he's won elections over liberal Democrats
yes.
before. I mean, he's a good guy. And then we have Scott Sturgill, who is a Seminole County guy. He's well known in these circles, and he has been working, knocking doors and sending mailers. So, I don't know what's going to happen. I think Sturgill's going to win Seminole. I think Miller's going to win Orange, and whoever can get the most crossover votes wins that election.
Well, Scott said that he's friends with Roger Stone. So
that's true. Roger Stone has endorsed him.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
That is interesting. All right, well, let's talk about the race between Alan Grayson and Darren Soto. It's getting a little bit nasty. They've sort of brought up personal issues in the race. They've talked about gun issues, allegations of paid protesters at campaign events. Dick Batchelor, what's going on here?
I was at the debate at Tiger Bay when they debated each other. I was sitting up front, and a reporter asked me afterwards to respond to the experience. And I said, have you ever been to a Rocky Horror Picture Show? You know, you can't get an umbrella or a tarpaulin or something. You need to be covered because it got really, really personal and nasty, as you mentioned. Here's what I think is going on there. It's that if you look at the district southeast, Orange County, Osceola County, and it goes over to Polk County to Bartow, right? So it's a moderate district, but you've got Darren Soto, incumbent. You know, he's a Puerto Rican. He's been endorsed by John Lewis, National Association of Women, Gabby Giffords groups. He's gotten all the endorsements. On the other hand, Grayson is trying to run what I call the sliver of MoveOn.org to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, well, you know, look what happened in New York where a 10-year incumbent was beat by a socialist. I said, well, let me tell you, Bartow is not the Bronx. You might have some Democrats in Bartow, but you ain't got no socialists. So I think Darren's in a good position. His incumbency, raising money, his endorsements. And I think he's chipping away, I think, at that more liberal wing of the party.
Mm-hmm.
So Grayson, while he's got name recognition, having served before, I still think Darren Soto's in the strongest position.
And he's up in the polls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. In the last minute or so here, the mayoral race for Orange County, what's standing out for you, Dick Batchelor, about this race? What is the defining issue here?
I think the public safety is because the incumbent sheriff of 10 years is running. So public safety is a big, big issue with him. I think the Rob Pinto has kind of differentiated himself by saying, I'm in the private sector. I can bring private sector corporate values to government, help it run better. Pete Clark, the incumbent county commissioner, just has not gotten any traction saying, I worked for the county for 30 years. I've been a county commissioner. Doesn't have any traction. Hasn't raised any money. Jerry Demings has raised about $1.3 million. He's got name recognition. Not only is he on the ballot, but Congresswoman Val Demings is on the ballot in the primary with that name recognition strong. But as far as the issue, they talk about job creation, public safety, and some things like that. But really there's not been one issue that I think being able to tease apart in this race where one candidate's broken from the pack.
Michelle Littell, I know it's the Orange County race, but sometimes Orange County issues become Seminole County issues, right? Like housing. So what, from Seminole County, what are you looking at in the Orange County mayoral race and saying this could be interesting or important for folks in Seminole County?
Well, I think Seminole County is looking to find out what their views are on the rural area,
right,
and that transitional area, because that is a huge issue in Seminole County right now. And in East Orange—
What is Seminole County's motto these days? I don't think it's Orlando North anymore,
it's the natural choice. Orlando North is only used to bring people in, like, on their tourism. So if they go to Boise, Idaho, and they have tourism trying to bring people here, they'll call it Orlando North. But locally, we're the natural choice.
Mm-hmm. And that natural choice could be threatened by development, which is
people are saying. Yeah, and so we want to know where the Orange County candidates and mayor stand on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Littell is a Republican political analyst. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Dick Batchelor, Democratic political analyst. Thank you, Dick.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll have a history of broadcasting in Florida, and stay tuned for some new music from Beth McKee from the Swamp Sisters. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Don R. Coley Jr. started his career as a rock and roll DJ as a teenager in Orlando. He later served in the US Navy and worked in advertising and public relations before returning to broadcasting with stints in marketing, community relations, programming, and as the station manager of Channel 12 in West Palm Beach. He has a new book out. It's called Towers in the Sand, The History of Florida Broadcasting. Don Coley, thank you so much for joining us.
Matthew, thank you very much.
Tell me about that first gig. You were a teenager when you first started your career in broadcasting. How did you land that gig?
Well, I must confess that I had some family help in that. My father actually was one of the first general managers of WLOF AM radio station in Orlando in the early 1950s. And so through that connection, I had a connection to broadcasting. My father later owned a radio station in West Palm Beach. And so I was able to get my broadcast license, which you needed at that time. And because we had family friends at the radio station, I can say I was born with a silver spoon or silver microphone in my mouth and was able to get in. My first job was playing religious tapes on Sunday mornings. And then they let me have first 1 hour, then 2 hours on Sunday mornings to play rock and roll music. And that expanded to Saturday and Sunday night, 6 to midnight, which I had a ball.
It's a bit of a transition going from playing religious material to the Beatles and other rock and roll, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Quite frankly, I didn't listen to a lot of the tapes that I was playing. I was too busy trying to figure out, how to run the board and do everything else you had to do at the radio station. But, it was a matter of just rolling tapes and monitoring the transmitter at that point. So it was an relatively easy transition. And rock and roll back in the mid-1960s was really, just coming to age. It was the beginning of the Beatles invasion, and WLOF was at that moment. I just happened to be, I've always been lucky. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, as that radio station absolutely took off and just owned the Orlando teenage market for years and years and years.
You know, public media has this role of kind of connecting people in the aftermath of events like hurricanes. What about the role of commercial television and radio, though? How do you think that's changed compared to what it was like back when you were starting your career?
Well, commercial television, I think, does an incredible job in helping people monitor the progress of storms as they're approaching. I think they do a great job at helping people prepare for storms, and certainly the coverage as a storm is approaching is just unparalleled. You know, I've read a lot of statistics. The Weather Channel does a really good job. When the storm is kind of way out there and you're not really sure where it's going, people tend to kind of watch the Weather Channel or the national newscast to see what's going on. But the closer it gets, the more they rely on their local radio and television stations, and television especially these days, to really start to say, okay, what does this mean to me? What does this mean to my house, my neighbors, my family in this area as this storm is approaching? And then in the aftermath of the storm, all of the network trucks pack up their gear and they head back to wherever the next disaster is. But it's the local stations, the public television stations, or public radio stations, excuse me, and the commercial television, and in few cases the commercial radio stations, are the ones that really stick with it and are there to tell people where to get ice if they don't have power, where to get water, what to do, where to evacuate if their home has been damaged. All of that important information that lasts days, if not weeks, after a storm or an event has taken place.
Don Coley, you open your book with a chapter about the role of Channel 9 and Joseph Brickner taking on the Klan and integration. Talk to us about what Brickner's role was with that aspect of American history and what the station meant as far as getting that message out.
When Joe came to town, he was born in Detroit, in a poor neighborhood, witnessed the struggles of people, black and white, to simply get along in those days. And when he came to Orlando, he realized that he was in what was then a small southern town, a segregated town, literally two sides of the tracks in downtown Orlando in terms of where the blacks lived and shopped and did all of their commerce and where the white people were. And Joe realized that that was not a healthy situation. So it was a very, very dangerous, turbulent time. And Joe Bruckner said, there's two sides of this. Number one, it's not fair. It's not right in his view. Number two, his appeal to business and to Orlando businessmen is it's not good for business. Riots shut down towns. They shut down cities. They destroy things. And that's not good for business. So Joe Bruckner approached Bob Carr, who was the mayor of Orlando at the time, and helped convince Mayor Carr that Orlando needed to take a leadership role in this. And through Orlando, through an organization that the mayor organized, and through courageous editorials and news coverage on behalf of broadcast on WLOF-TV, WFTV Channel 9, the end result was Orlando peacefully integrated lunch counters, businesses, movie theaters, and motels at a time that other southern cities were facing tremendous violence and riots in their downtowns. So it was a tremendous example of the power of a local broadcaster who had the courage to stand up for what was right and use that giant megaphone that he had of an over-the-air television station, one of two in town, to broadcast those messages and make people think and realize about the injustice of some of the things that were happening.
Don Coley Jr. is the author of Towers in the Sand, The History of Florida Broadcasting. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, and keep up the good work at WMFE.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last October. Still to come, Beth McKee has a new album out. New music from the founder of the Swamp Sisters when Intersection returns. We're back in a minute.
Where is my sweet Sari? I've searched everywhere. She never called me out of bed. She never combed my hair. Not out in the kitchen.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Beth McKee has a new album out called Dreamwood Acres. She joins us now in studio with guitarist Grant Payton and a song called Mercy Point.
This song is actually a byproduct of my Swamp Sisters Songwriters Circle meetings where I issue a monthly seed phrase, starter phrase, or word. And the very first one of those, the phrase was Mercy Point. So my angle on Mercy Point wound up being a story about the Underground Railroad. And it's kind of from the viewpoint of maybe a young plantation owner's daughter, a little girl who's been taken care of by a lady named Sari, who has departed for better places. So this is Mercy Point. Where is my sweet Sari? I've searched everywhere. She never called me out of bed. She never combed my hair. Not out in the kitchen, but down by the chicken coop. She ain't making biscuits or shining daddy's boots. Last night she took me in, singing sweet and low songs of chariots. And then she sang about a train, everybody get on board. Then look up in the sky and follow the drinking gore. promises there'll be tribulation. But our faith will carry us to Canaan. I dreamed I was a butterfly riding on a wagon wheel. Then I was a blackbird flying out across the field. I saw Sari in the dark, walking on the river bend. She said, I'm headed to Jerusalem, headed to Jerusalem, headed to Jerusalem, I'm headed to Jerusalem. Sweet Sari, I wish she'd taken me. Without her, I'm an orphan. She's my family tree. But I will sing her song. They'll be my reminder to carry on until I'm grown. Then I'm gonna find her.
Beth McKee, accordion and vocals, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, what a treat. Thank you for having me here.
And Grant Payson on guitar and vocals, thanks as well.
Thank you.
So you've got a new album out, Dreamwood Acres. Tell me about the process of putting this together.
Well, it was a wonderful process because I recorded it in the basement studio of a friend in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, over the past summer, last summer. And a little bit before that, my friend is John Fiffner. He recorded, engineered, produced, co-wrote one of the songs with me and played several parts, played bass on several tracks and some guitar too. And John's other job is that he is the chief engineer, I would say, for Mitch Easter at his studio, the Fidelitorium in Kernersville, North Carolina, which is a legendary studio where the whole indie rock movement pretty much emanated. So this was a different process for me working in North Carolina with a North Carolina indie rock style producer. I guess he is that. He's just really a good friend now and fellow musician. And also we were aided and abetted by a friend named Jeffrey Dean Foster, who is a wonderful singer-songwriter guitarist in Winston-Salem that has roots in the indie rock scene as well. So Grant flew up. I flew Grant up. My husband Juan Perez played the drums, and we just had a blast recording these songs and let the songs kind of dictate what the style would be. We didn't, you know, behold ourselves to any one particular genre or style. And so I have dubbed this record, the style of this music, anytime asked. I'm asked, well, what kind of music is it? I say it's free range music because I just let the songs go where they want and they lay little eggs all around.
And a lot of your songs evolved out of your songwriters circle.
Yes. Group. I have a group of women friend songwriters that meets at my house. Right now we're meeting twice a month and also broadcasting Facebook Live shows or demonstrations every other Monday night from our new home at the Blue Bamboo Center for the Arts in Winter Park. And yes, quite a few of these songs grew out of a song challenge that I send ahead of time for each of our gatherings for us to meet. Then we kind of play all our songs for each other. It's just kind of a reason to write a song, which is seems to be what I need.
Grant Payton, the cover of this new album, Dreamwood Acres, has a beautiful Jerry Ellsman photograph on it. I know there's kind of a connection between Jerry Ellsman and you and Beth and the way this whole thing came together. Just tell me a little bit about that.
Well, yeah. My dad and his brothers have a bluegrass band, or had one. My uncle is, he used to work at one of the museums up in Gainesville and got familiar with Jerry Ellsman. And eventually Jerry asked my Uncle Mike to play his birthday party and brought up the rest of the brothers. And that was about 15 years ago. And the whole family's kind of had a relationship with him just playing at his parties and coming to hang out. And we got a bunch of – he actually has paid us in prints before, and we got a bunch of prints hanging around in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a shrine to Jerry Ellsman at our house. But, Beth was looking for album artwork and talking about, I want something kind of surreal, dreamy. And I said, why don't you check out this guy, Jerry Ellsman? And she liked some of his stuff, ended up contacting him and got permission to use one of the photos for the album art.
Mm-hmm.
I think it looks really cool.
And you've got some prints in your house too?
Yes. Well, the byproduct of this, the use sort of our payment for the use of the image on the album cover, he was like, well, they can come play with the Payton brothers for my birthday party. So we went up to Gainesville for his 84th birthday party a couple of months ago. And it was just such a delight to hang with, meet the people that are his friends, you know. And my husband and I were also paid in prints, so we're very happy to have some Ellsman for our collection.
So what about the next few weeks? What have you got coming up in the near future?
Well, I'm right here in sunny Central Florida for the next couple of weeks. One thing I'm particularly excited about on Saturday, August 18th, is a show at the Blue Bamboo Center for the Arts that the Swamp Sisters Songwriter Circle will be doing. And it will feature myself, Renee Orozqueta, who came and did a performance with me here for you a couple of years ago. Also performing will be Amy Robbins, who has a band called Maple Sparrow, Americana kind of alt-roots band. Hannah Harbor, who has a band called Hannah Harbor in the Lionhearts, will be sitting in the circle. And a recent performer for you, Zoya Zafar, will be sitting in the circle at the Blue Bamboo also. So what we do is we play acoustic and in the round and sometime. Then we also play some songs as an ensemble so that we support each other on some of our songs. And Tracy Gibbs, who's a wonderful percussionist, comes in for some of the songs, and we just kind of are a band all of a sudden. So it's kind of the best of both worlds, of like the songwriter vibe and then the energetic vibe of an ensemble.
So tell me a little bit about the next song you're going to play.
Well, the next song is called Resurrection Mary, and it's sort of based on, it's also a product of my Swamp Sister Songwriter Circle workshops. And the catchphrase that was incorporated into this song was, she put her hand out. Which I just kind of has, it's a line in the second verse, I think. But I wound up writing a song about a hitchhiker ghost who actually is a legendary outside of Chicago and is known as Resurrection Mary. So that's the title of the song.
All right, take it away.
Chicago night, so the story goes, she left the old Henry ballroom walking home alone. They found her lying peacefully on the wrong side of the road, straight to resurrection, wasn't too far to go. on the highway to justice, where vision roams. Always in a party dress and a gossamer coat, she'll put her hand out, beckon me with her eyes. Many have lived the legend of taking her for a ride. Resurrection Mary, dancing all night long at the feet of Jesus in the shadow.
Beth McKee's new album is called Dreamwood Acres, and to take us out, here's a track called Echo Chamber.
One, two, three.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Brenda Argetta. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on the NPR One app and listen back to previous episodes at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty, and thanks for listening.
Can give you your news, reverberating your views in your echo chamber.